Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. I'm so excited. And without a good hip, you ain't hopping. And the first man to bring hip replacements to Los Angeles was an orthopedic surgeon named Robert Rosenfeld. Tom Flores, thank you so much for waking up early with us. I'm so excited to talk to you, and I want to talk to you also about your friend, the great Dr. Robert Rosenfeld.
Well, he was quite a guy. I mean, he's a legend in Los Angeles in orthopedic surgery and just an overall wonderful person, very caring. Got to know him pretty well, quite well when I was when we were in L.A. Even before that, because he used to come up to Oakland. He was our team doctor, team orthopedic doctor.
Did you ever have to have surgery with Dr. Rosenfeld?
No.
Thank God.
I didn't have it either. Of course, I got hit a few times on the sideline as a head coach, but never had surgery for that. Never had surgery when I was playing.
Oh, my God.
With Dr. Rosenfeld.
That's amazing, Tom Flores, that you stayed so healthy. I interviewed Tony Gonzalez 16 seasons in the NFL. He missed one game. That's amazing. Good for you.
Yeah, well, I had some shoulder problems, you know, in other areas, but never anything that required major reconstruction of your knee or shoulder or things of that nature. Although I'm paid for it now.
Well, Father Time is undefeated. We call it at Cedars Alta Cocaritis. Welcome to the club. But the good news is in 2017, our technology is not what it was when you played and when you coached, which is a big advance.
The technology nowadays is just remarkable. I mean,
yes.
It's some of it is almost routine, and it's good. That's what the medical field is all about, is get better, get better, and get better.
You know, even as a coach, player, you must be amazed. You watch on the sidelines now. They sit down with laptops looking at the defense and going over. In the 60s, you couldn't do that when you're trying to size up your opponent, right? I mean, you had to do it all by eye.
Yeah, you didn't. We didn't have the use. The only thing we had is the use of the old Bell and Howell projector after the game, watching the game film. And then they came along with Polaroid cameras, and then they could take snapshots during the game. But you couldn't have that done at the sideline. So you had to have it done up in the box, and then somebody had to take it all the way down to the field to show it to the coaches and players.
You know, learning about a person, it's such a delight to be able to talk to you, Tom Flores. Thank you once again for getting up early with us. I really appreciate it. I want to thank Dr. Fred Nicola for making this happen as well. My father was a carpenter. My mother was a nurse. I think I'm genetically programmed to be a carpenter in the body, and I became an orthopedic surgeon. Tell me a little bit, where did the love of football, specifically as a sport, how old were you when you got shot in the heart by Cupid, who said, yep, this is the sport I would love to do? Take us back to the beginning of your life.
Well, growing up in the San Joaquin Valley, in the days when television wasn't as predominant as it is now, you know, you didn't see a lot of football. You saw it on the clips and on the newsreels. And most of the time, we saw East Coast football, Army, Navy, and Notre Dame. That was about it. The pros were not a big factor in those days. But the first time I ever picked up a football, I could throw it. And it was fun to throw and play catch and run around and catch the ball and throw the ball. It was not a passion, though, but it was fun to do. I played everything I could. I played basketball and baseball. Actually, basketball was my favorite sport. But it so happened that I was better at football. But my junior and senior year in high school, it became a bigger part of my life as far as the enjoyment. And then obviously when I went on to college, it was a part of my life along with, you know, the educational part. So it was good. It's something that you don't realize until you don't have it. And your passion is taken away from you. And that's when it happened. That's why I got into coaching. All of a sudden I missed football when I left as a player.
Got it.
And I said, wow, so I got to do something. I got to get back some way.
Interesting.
And fortunately I had an opening and took advantage of it, and here we are, 55 years later, whatever it is.
God. How about in high school? Was there a coach that kind of inspired you, that set you on your way? I asked Tony Gonzalez, whose voice do you hear in your head when you're running down the field as a pro playing for the Kansas City Chiefs? Do you hear your coach on the sideline? Do you hear your college coach's voice? And he said, no, I hear my high school football's coach in my head as I'm running down the field, even as a pro. Did you have a memorable coach in the beginning?
In the beginning, no. we had a good coach, and we won a lot of games at Sanger High School in the San Joaquin Valley, just outside of Fresno. But there wasn't, you know, every coach that I had some strong points, and I always remember the good points about the coaches. I don't remember many of the bad coach parts because you don't need those later in life. But the good things that they did, like my high school coach, Claire Slaughter, he was, you know, he was tough and worked us hard. But he wasn't a passing coach. Junior college coach was very organized. But my college coach probably was the most influential in my early years, Bruce Myers, because the way he treated everybody, the way he treated us after football, and the way he treated us to this day, he left a big footprint on all of us at College of Pacific, little old College of Pacific, which is no longer even playing football.
So he's the guy who kind of inspired you to be quiet about it, but do it right, I take it. He gave you the biggest inspiration.
Yeah, he did. And you know, his shadow is still there. He's still alive. He's 91 years old, I think. And then the next one that formed my professional life was Al Davis. When he came to Oakland, I took a lot of what he had and went on with it.
In many respects, he was misunderstood, right? I mean, Al Davis is not, you probably know him better than anybody. The reputation he has is not really who the man was, right? I mean, your take on him is going to be of a different way than his public persona.
Oh, absolutely. I saw every side of him. And there's a side that never made the headlines, never made the radio shows or television shows, the talking heads, never got into the personal side of him. But that was by design. He liked to be a mystery man. He liked to be that maverick in a very competitive world. But he did have a soft side for those that he cared about and those that were loyal to him and the Raiders.
I got asked to go to dinner when Dr. Rosenfeld really took me under his wing in 1989 at Cedars. He said, I want you to come to dinner with me tonight and meet Al Davis. So we go to this gangster Italian restaurant called Mateo's on Westwood. I sit down with these two guys, Al Davis and Rosenfeld, and I'm like so excited. The waiter comes up. Al Davis looks at the waiter and said, bring us some pizza bread. I looked at the menu. I go, there's no pizza bread on the menu. And Rosenfeld and Al Davis look at me and go, we don't care what the menu says. We're getting pizza bread. Does that sound familiar to you about Rosenfeld and Al Davis?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Listen, if it's not on the menu, well, we'll make it anyway. Like I said, Al was not conventional. He liked to be off the wall sometimes and unpredictable.
Oh, man. Listen, as such a successful man in this beloved sport of football, I got to believe along the way, so many people wanted to meet you. Did you meet Nat King Cole? Did you meet Muhammad Ali? Did you meet President John F. Kennedy? Tell us a little bit about the people that you met along the way that you were a fan of.
Well, I met Muhammad Ali, sat next to him at a banquet and chatted with him, and he was quite a character. I mean, he was always a big jokester and pulling little pranks if he could do it. But it was a thrill to be around him because he was such a great fighter and an athlete and personality. And then I got to meet Sugar Ray Robinson, who was, when I was a kid growing up, you know, I remember he was at his peak. So I got a chance to meet him. He came to our practices a lot. And some of the other luminaries of Hollywood, James Gardner was a big fan of ours. He was on our sideline a lot. Got a chance to talk to President Reagan after we won our Super Bowl. And we're looking at each other on the TV. And you know, as I accepted the trophy for the L.A. Raiders. When we moved to L.A., it was Los Angeles, I should say. It was an opening. It was a grand adventure in a different world.
Yes. Let me ask you, Tom, of all the things of football, let's pretend it's a metaphor for life. There's a beginning of the game, there's the middle of the game, there's the end of the game, just like our lives. From an artistic perspective, what is your favorite part of the game? Is it offense? Is it defense? Is it special teams? Is it a running play? Is it a pass play? Is it all of it, or is there something that you get the most pleasure out of?
My pleasure was always the passing game. I was a quarterback. I loved to throw the ball, and loved it when I became a player. I loved to, you know, throw the ball down the field, and then I loved it when I was a coach. I liked to design plays that would get the ball down the field. But that was it. Throwing the ball was delightful. I mean, it was just exciting. A lot of adrenaline would flow when they were getting ready for the game and warming up. And then if you succeeded, it was overwhelming, the thrills in your competition. And just completing one simple pass that was almost perfect. You always work for perfection. Mm-hmm. Wasn't always there, but, I mean, that was where all the excitement was. And when I became a coach, probably the most fun of everything was when you design something, you talk about it, and you spend all week in planning your game plan, and then all of a sudden, suddenly, it works. That was quite a thrill because you're no longer out there, but you're pulling the strings. It was just, to this day, still the same way.
You know, you're like a surgeon, Tom Flores, in that regard. I mean, you go to surgery, you take a history, you do a physical, you look at the x-rays, the MRI, now you open someone up, and guess what? The artery's not where it's supposed to be, the nerve is someplace else. You got a game plan, but it's like what Mike Tyson says. It's nice to have a game plan until someone punches you in the mouth. So it's what you do during the game to modify what you're doing. Tell us about what it was like in the 60s and 70s. We didn't really have offensive, defensive coordinators. So John Madden is the head coach, but there is no title of offensive coordinator. Greg Papa says Tom Flores was the offensive coordinator. Tell us how it changed. What was it like in the 60s and 70s when you were an assistant coach for John Madden?
Well, in the 60s, I was a player in the 60s, and most coaching staffs consisted of maybe four or five coaches. That was it, as opposed to 20 coaches today, assistant coaches. When I went into coaching in the 70s with John Madden, I was hired as the receiver coach. So I coached the wide receivers and the tight ends, and then worked with the quarterbacks. And basically, I worked on the passing game for John. And I was probably the closest guy to a coordinator without having the label as a coordinator. But you're right. No one had titles. We were just a coach. Yeah. And I helped design the game plan, and it was a team effort as far as the coaches were concerned. We didn't have that many coaches in the 70s. We had grown to maybe seven coaches, six mm-hmm. coaches, and that was it. No special team coach until about the mid-70s. Most teams had them. But I had the ear of the head coach and then the ear of the quarterback because I met with him.
Well, I want you to know, Tom Flores, now that Derek Carr's ankle is fixed, that fracture has more bone around it than he had before. So he doesn't have a bad ankle anymore. He has a better ankle now because of the healing bone around the fracture he had than he had before. Derek Carr. Tom, when I see Derek Carr, how he handles himself with his teammates, with the media, the dignity and the class that he carries himself with, he is a junior version of Tom Flores.
Well, that's a very complimentary, but I'll tell you, it's a good point because you're like me. I watch a quarterback. I watch players when they're not involved, mm-hmm. when they're away from the action, just mm-hmm. to see how their body action is, and especially quarterbacks. How are they in the huddle? How are they mm-hmm. outside the huddle, on the sideline, on the bench? And Carr is always engaged in what's going on, and that's a real plus for a quarterback.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you. We all of Los Angeles wants to thank you for getting up early to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope the next time we meet, you and I will be at Mateo's, and I will order the pizza bread.
I remember Mateo's well.
All right, have a great day. Thanks so much. It's really a pleasure to talk to you, Tom.
All right.
The great Tom Flores from the Oakland Raiders. What a joy. You could tell the dignity, how quiet. He just does not want to take the credit for everything. But, man, he needs to be in the Hall of Fame. All right, coming up next, I'll take your calls. We'll do some clap revision. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warrior Show here on ESPN LA 710. Wow. Steve Paulette, you're amazing. This is the great Desi Arnaz, another trailblazer in the TV business. He's the first guy who said, hey, maybe we should record this black and white TV show. We can replay it another time. Thank you. That's why I Love Lucy is the number one show all over the world in syndication. Three TV cameras at one time. This was all the idea of another great Latino in Los Angeles, Desi Arnaz. Fantastic. But Tom Flores does not want you to see him. He's proud of his heritage. But he wants to be the best quarterback when he was a player, the best assistant coach, the best head coach. That's how he wants you to judge him. And you know what? That's the lesson to be learned. You really want to get a job because you're checking a box that a quota is matched? No. You want to do it because you're the best at what you do. All right. Let's take some calls. The number is 877-710-ESPN. Let's go to Fidel and Silmar. You're on with Dr. Clapper. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
All right, Fidel. What do you do for a living?
I'm a plumber.
All right. That means you're a vascular surgeon, in my mind, or a urologist.
Opening up all the drains.
Exactly right. If you don't think, Fidel, the exact same thing that you're fixing, that we got to fix in the operating room, you kid, even our tools look the same. It's fabulous.
Oh, wow.
This is why I became an orthopedic surgeon, and I want to use a hammer, nail, drill, saws. So thank you. I get to work on bone instead of wood. It's great. All right, and where did you grow up, Fidel?
In Silmar.
In Silmar, where the hang gliders are?
Yes.
Did they ever fly over your house?
Close enough. I can see them every other morning.
Did you ever see one crash?
Yes.
This is a terrible thing. So, I'm going to be 60 years old in July, next month. What can I do at 60 that will just blow my mind? I'm thinking my poor wife has to put up with this. I got to do something to say. It's a monumental birthday. When I turned 50 and 55, I went to see Mount Rushmore. It's a monumental birthday. You got to go see a monument. Okay, I'm not going to go when I'm 60. What am I going to do? You know what I'm going to do, Fidel? I am taking a hang gliding lesson. I want to fly when I turn 60. So, two Wednesdays from now, I'm going to go to El Segundo, and I'm going to fly. I'm going to learn how to fly. Because I'm not doing Silmar, because I could die if I crash there. But I figure 5 feet above the beach, I can't die. All right, how can I help you? What's up?
I have an injury on top of the muscle on top of my forearm, and it hasn't healed, and I don't even know what the muscle is called.
All right, so let's get into it together. Let's do some clapper vision. So, palms, first of all, you're a righty or a lefty?
I'm a righty.
When did this problem start, and which arm is it, right or left?
It's my right, and as soon as I tightened or torqued to open a clean out, I felt something.
So, here we go. Fidel, palms up, okay? Your thumb is there, your little finger's there. With your palm up, which side of your forearm? Is it the thumb side of your forearm or your little finger side of the forearm?
Thumb side of my forearm.
Okay. Is it near the elbow or is it further down the forearm?
Further down the forearm.
About how far between your elbow and your wrist, where is the pain? Halfway, closer to the elbow, closer to the wrist?
Halfway.
Halfway. Huh. Okay. Has it been x-rayed?
It has not.
Okay. And so tell me, when what can make it hurt more? Squeezing like a doorknob to turn it or to just go palms up? When does it hurt the most? What can elicit the pain?
When I turn it or when I pitch or when I throw a curveball.
Okay. So this is what you did to yourself. And no numbness or tingling, right?
No numbness or tingling.
So the... This is just so fascinating. I just love all this stuff. In order for you to pick up a can of soda, okay, or beer, it's Saturday, it's beer. We'll say Corona. Adolfo, we're going to say it's Corona. So in order for you to pick up a can of beer, you have to extend your wrist and at the same time flex your fingers. There's a lot going on with the cables, better known as your tendons, in order to do this activity. In order for you to come to your front door and use the doorknob to open the door, same thing. You have to extend your wrist, and then you need to flex your fingers around the doorknob, and now you need to rotate the doorknob, right? Circular. You need to essentially go from palms down. That's how you're meeting the doorknob, palms down, and now you're rotating to palms up. When your palm is down, we have a fancy word for it called pronation. When your palm is up, fancy word, supination. This rotation of your forearm allows you to do this activity. The muscles, and there's just three of them that allow you to extend your wrist. They are on the thumb side of your elbow. They anchor themselves like Velcro into the bone at the thumb side of the end of your humerus bone, just above your elbow, and the muscle belly, the actual meat, goes from your elbow midway to your forearm, and then it becomes a cable. It becomes a tendon. These three muscles, the brachioradialis, the brachio in Latin means arm. Radialis is the forearm bone, the radius bone. So that's all these words really mean. It's just identifying where these bones start and where they these muscles originate and where they finish. Brachioradialis, which allows you to extend your wrist. The extensor carpi radialis, longus and brevis. There's two other muscles buried below this side of muscles on the thumb side of your elbow. These thick muscles, their muscles bellies go halfway down your forearm, and then they become tendons. In addition, the most powerful muscle that allows you to now rotate your forearm, to turn the doorknob, to pitch, to do all the things you're describing, actually comes from higher up. It's the biceps muscle. So when you make a muscle, when I ask you to make a muscle in your arm, to show me your guns, if you will, that arm muscle that you're flexing is actually the biceps muscle, but it attaches to the backside of the radius bone, kind of where these muscle bellies I just described end halfway in your forearm. So your location is exactly the spot where these two muscle groups are performing this activity of rotating your forearm to rotate the doorknob, as well as to extend your wrist. And that's the troublemaker. You don't do surgery, Fidel, for this. You don't do cortisone shots for this. You can wear a sleeve. This is not really going to solve the problem. Let me tell you what's going to make you better. How old are you, Fidel?
35.
So this is when Achilles tendons like Kobe Bryant start to break down. Father time, the door is cracked open. He's entering your body. It seems young at 35. The door is slightly open. I'm 60. Father time is actually sitting next to me right now at the radio station. But the door is cracked open when you're 35. So the elasticity of the muscle is ever so slightly changing. And you need to recognize this is a degenerative problem. It's not inflamed, it's degenerating. So this is what I want you to do. You're going to go to Big Five or online and buy yourself a 3-pound or a 5-pound dumbbell. And you're going to put your forearm holding the dumbbell on a table. With you holding the dumbbell, your hand is hanging off the end of the desk. And you're going to extend the dumbbell, extend your wrists, lifting up the dumbbell. And trust me, it's going to hurt. Pump it a couple of times till it hurts. Put the weight down. An hour later, you're on the phone, you're watching TV, pick up the dumbbell. I need you to do this again. I want you to do this exercise of extending your wrist with the dumbbell with your forearm supported on a desk 4 or 5 times during the day. In 3 to 4 weeks, it's not going to happen right away, you will be strengthening the muscles and this pain should go away. If it doesn't, Fidel, you need an exam, you need an x-ray, and you may need an MRI. But this is how I would handle it first. I don't want you taking medication to take the symptoms away. You need to treat the problem. I don't want to treat the cough. I want to treat the pneumonia. You know what I mean? I don't want to treat the symptom. So do this. If it's not better in a month, then you need to get an exam, an x-ray, and an MRI. Okay, Fidel?
Okay. Thank you so much, doctor.
Fidel, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to find a total stranger today and do something nice for them. That's how you'll be thanking me. Okay?
I will.
All right.
Thank
God bless you. Have a great day. All right. Keep going. Yeah. I love this. Great. I love the world without advertising. This is fantastic. All right. Let's quickly take another call. Let's go to Isaac. Isaac, where are you calling from?
Dr. Clapper, I'm calling from Alhambra, California.
Nice. And how young are you?
I'm 74.
Nice. What did you do for a living?
I'm a veteran, a Vietnam veteran.
Oh, wow.
I go to the VA for classes. But
what did you do for a living? Forget the Vietnam War. What did you do to make a living?
I was an actor.
Oh.
And I worked as a general manager at some radio stations.
Oh, good.
In Arizona.
Nice. All right.
But
how can I help you, Isaac?
Could I mention about Al Davis one thing?
Of course. I only got a few minutes to go.
Okay. I happened to be at the Los Angeles City Hall to see Gilbert Lindsay, a former councilman.
Mm-hmm.
and got in the elevator when Al Davis was getting in to meet with Mayor Bradley.
Mm-hmm.
And there was these two rather large African-American guys that I guess his bodyguards. And I looked at him and I said, Coach. Only I didn't call him Mr. Davis. I said, Coach. And I looked at him, and they jumped in front of him, you know. And I said, what are you guys, crazy? I'm 5'6". What am I going to do to him? And he pushed him away. And then I talked to him and said, bring them Raiders. I didn't say Raider Nation because there wasn't a Raider Nation then. But I said, we're the radical Raider fans. You know? And I said, bring those Raiders. Bring those Raiders here to L.A. And he was going to be meeting with Mayor Bradley at the time.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's a great story. Al Davis, he was like 9 feet tall when it came to his personality, but he did a lot of stuff behind the scenes. He hired the first Latino as a quarterback, the first Latino as a head coach. And you know who that was? My guest at 7:15 was the great Tom Flores.
Tom Flores is the best.
He's the best. That's why we had him on. And Tom Flores needs to be in the Hall of Fame, Isaac. And I hope I can make that happen in some small way.
Be a part of it, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. All right, quickly. I got a minute left.
Okay.
The answer to your question, Isaac, you're pregnant. Okay? That's the answer to the question.
Who told you?
The rabbit died, Isaac.
Anyway, I was acting like a youngster, and I slid across the floor on my socks like Risky Business, and ended up taking a tremendous fall, and I felt a tear on my left side of my knee. Not the knee itself, but the...
Okay. So there's a book I wrote, Isaac, with Linda Huey called Heal Your Knees. It's all about pool exercise. It's going to be 100 degrees where you live this whole summer. Half an hour, 3 days a week, I need you to get in the pool. Walk forwards, walk backwards. Don't let them do cortisone shots.
No.
Stay away from surgery, Isaac. If it don't get better, then you need to call me and I'm going to help you again, all right? And thanks so much for listening.
Thank you.
All right, God bless you, Isaac. Appreciate it. All right, Warriors. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors show here on ESPN LA 710. Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. That's the who. I can see for miles. That's what today's show is all about. The topic, vision, seeing, imagining, painting pictures in your brain, in sports, in medicine, and in art. Right now I'm being joined by one of my favorite artists, the great Weiland. Weiland, thanks so much for making time this morning to join us.
Hey, Dr. Clapper, it's an honor to be on your show. First time I've done ESPN, and of course I'm a big sports fan. You know, art is really, you know, what I've done since I was a little kid. And luckily, I've never had to get a real job. And so it's been a pretty cool ride. I also had my birthday last Saturday. I just turned 61.
Oh, wow.
Tom Hanks, my favorite actor, was born on the same day, same year as myself. So happy birthday, Tom.
You know, I, in preparation for this conversation of ours, I've been a big fan of your work for years. Even though I'm an orthopedic surgeon, my passion is sculpting. So every year I go to Italy to Michelangelo's quarry, and I take the stone from his quarry, and I sculpt in the white marble. And it's a different medium, certainly, than painting. What you do, it's subtractive. You have to destroy the rock in order to create something, whereas what you do is additive. You put stuff on a blank canvas. But in preparation for this conversation we were going to have, I went on YouTube and I watched you paint a picture, and you did something very similar to what I see and appreciate in Michelangelo, which is try to get at the complexity of human emotion. Obviously, yours is not human, yours is marine life, but the idea of turning Mary's face slightly to the side and slightly down, taking a solid rock and making it into an emotion. She's lost her son, and you can see the sadness and feel it in the stone. So here I am, quietly, with my daughter sitting next to me, looking at you, about to paint on YouTube a dolphin sticking his head out of the water. And what do? The first thing you start drawing is the dolphin's eye. And then you build this entire painting of a dolphin around the eye and then the water that's around him. But the emotion that comes out of the fact that you started with the eye blew me away. How much do you try to convey emotion in your work, even though it is of marine life and porpoises and whales and whatnot. Tell us about emotion in your painting.
You know, I'm a diver, okay? I've been diving for over 30 years. And in fact, I got inducted into the International Scuba Diving Hall of Fame about 10 years ago with my hero, Jacques Cousteau.
Wow.
You know, and Cousteau, you know, he made beautiful films, The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau. But he was a poet, you know, the way that in his words and what he said. And he really inspired me. You know, I wanted to be a diver like Jacques Cousteau, but I've been a pure artist since I was four. But it's all about the emotion. It's all about the feeling. You know, it's like a great song. When you hear a great song, it moves you, you know. And art, you know, has that emotion. It has that feeling, you know, a good painting, a good sculpture. And that's exactly what you're talking about. And artists have that vision. That's what art is really about. I don't know what we're given a gift. We can develop it, even if we're not so-called artists, you know, natural artists. But art is so powerful. A good friend of mine was Leroy Neiman. Remember, he was the Olympic artist.
Yes.
And ironically, he told me, whenever I retire, I'd like you to be the Olympic artist.
Oh, wow.
I go, really? Come on, man. And, you know, because I've been watching him since I was a kid. And we became great friends when he drove past one of my murals in Honolulu, Big Wall in Waikiki. And I guess he had his driver pull the car over on the sidewalk. And he stood there and went, oh, my God, who is this Weiland guy?
Wow.
And he invited me to dinner that night with the guys from Magnum PI with Tom Selleck and everybody. And he sat next to me. He said, how the hell do you paint that big? I go, well, first of all, I see it in my mind's eye from across the street. You know, from several blocks away, I take that vision in my mind's eye. And then when I get up against the wall and I'm 18, 20 stories high, I imagine that whale, you know, basically swimming or breaching right in front of me, and I'm painting it on the wall as it goes by. So I'm really having an out-of-body experience, and it's really weird because as I'm painting this whale, my mind's eye is still across the street, so seeing everything, the big picture.
Michelangelo's biographer was a man named Vasari, and Vasari was one of the few people he let into his studio to watch him work. And Vasari said watching him work was as though a woman, nude, submerged under the water of a bathtub. Watching Michelangelo work was as though someone pulled the drain, and as the water recedes in the bath, the figure appears. So tell us about your process. When you see that empty canvas, that 20-story building and the wall, do you always go to the center? Do you always tell us about how you reveal in the opposite way the figure?
Yeah, what I do first and foremost is try to establish the habitat, the environment, the ocean realm. And then I look into that giant background, and I imagine these whales moving through it. Now, as I add one whale, it may tell me where the mother and the calf may be, where the escort, okay? I like the nature of buildings and walls, you know, and I kind of go with that architecture, so that plays a role. Not everyone's going to see a great whale. But if you can see them on a building or a giant, you know, monumental sculpture, you get a pretty good sense of them. And I've spent a lot of time in the water with these animals. That's why, like you said, the eyes are so realistic, and there's something about it. It's very moving. And that's what I really try to capture.
Movement. Even though your pictures are still, it's a snapshot, you're trying to depict movement. Got to be the greatest challenge.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
Yeah, you have to. Otherwise, it's just stiff and sterile. So that's the big goal. And I don't know if you know, but I did the first whaling wall ocean mural in Laguna Beach where I live. And then I decided, a reporter like yourself said, hey, how many are you going to paint? And I said, I'm going to paint 100. I should have said 10, man. I would have been done early. And I said, I think it's going to take 30 years to do it. I did 100 walls in 27 years. The last one was in Beijing. And the last one I did as the official artist for the U.S. Olympic team. You know, I didn't want the last one to be about me. I wanted to paint the Great Wall of China, 10 miles of it. And they said no. So we decided to do it on a mile-long canvas, different canvases, and have one for every single Olympic country, like 210 countries or something. So all the kids came out each day from every country in the world and painted with me. I mean, it was exhausting.
Oh,
it took 6 weeks, but we did it, and we put all the art across this lake in Beijing. And we called it Hands Across the Ocean. The idea that water connects all the people and countries of the world. So we did saltwater and freshwater habitats. The kids painted animals from their region of the world. Some of these animals, by the way, Dr. Clapper, have never been discovered. I've never seen them. Wow. But it doesn't mean they're not real.
Right.
They were awesome. And Picasso spent his entire life trying to paint like a kid.
Exactly.
It's almost impossible.
Well, Weiland, I'm Jewish. So when you go to Jerusalem, you see the Wailing Wall. This is what I've grown up hearing about, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. You bring new meaning to a Wailing Wall because you're actually painting a whale. I love this.
Yeah, and it's spelled differently. I don't want to get in trouble with all my friends. But, you know, listen, I so appreciate you for having me on ESPN, and I've had so much fun. And you know what's funny is artists like yourself, sculptors, you know, we always collide with sports stars because sports guys want to be artists.
Yep.
Artists want to be rock stars.
Right.
You know, rock stars want to be actors. So it's a big old mess, but it's very artistic, and there's a lot of fun involved. Albert Pujols and I became friends over his foundation, and he invited me to Yankee Stadium, the new one, a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't been there, so I went with John Lovitz, the crazy comedian. We're sitting there in Albert Pujols' seat, where his wife generally sits, right behind the plate, right?
Uh-huh.
So Albert comes out the first time, he's on deck, and he turns right at me. He points, "Hey, Weiland, you having fun?" I go, "Yeah, Albert, this is great, you know?" And he goes out there and hits a double, knocks in a run. So I was hoping he didn't strike out. I would have never been invited back. But, you know, sports, you know, there's a lot of good things in life, you know. And my paintings really depict, you know, the positive side of faith.
Yep.
It's how beautiful and enormous and great this animal is. But I hope I don't have to get to a place where I paint, you know, all the plastic islands floating in the
sea. No, you're not going to have to. You're not painting souvenirs. You paint nature, and that's what's beautiful. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Who are you, Weiland? Where did you grow up? What did your dad do for a living? How old were you when Cupid shot you in the heart and said, "You want to be an artist"?
Well, that's funny you ask, because I grew up far away from the ocean, you know, in Detroit. My parents were both auto workers. My mom was the first forklift driver for Chrysler, for Lee Iacocca, who I met at the Statue of Liberty dedication later and told him. But anyway, I grew up in Detroit. My mom raised four boys by herself, single mother. And she said to me at 16, "Are you going to get a job? Your three brothers have jobs." And I said, "I have a job. I'm an artist." And she encouraged it. She's actually here for the grand opening of my new gallery in Santa Monica.
Tell us about how excited you are about this new gallery.
Well, I'm really excited. You know, I love Santa Monica. I love California. I've always been kind of a California-type artist. And, you know, you were asking me how I got started. And, you know, I grew up in Detroit, no ocean, but surrounded by the Great Lakes. I'm a water sign. Everything in my life kind of connects to water. And then when I was 14, my mom did a little road trip out to California with all four boys. And, you know, the first thing I wanted to do is see the ocean. So my aunt took me to Laguna Beach, California, and I ran towards it. You know, I was in love with the ocean my whole life, you know, watching Jacques Cousteau. So I jumped under a wave. I was smart enough to go under it. You know, I watched these people come out here the first time and just get hammered.
Mm-hmm.
So I went under the wave, Dr. Clapper, and two gray whales, a mother and calf, spouted 10 yards from my face. It looked like, I thought I was looking at two dinosaurs, these barnacle-encrusted backs just rolling slowly, you know, through, you know, breaking the surface, and then the tail fluked up. And, you know, that's really the symbol of everything I do. But I'm 14 years old. I'm looking at two dinosaurs. And ironically, 10 years later, after that encounter, you know, I was 14 then, 10 years, almost to the exact day, I painted a portrait of those two whales on that wall by the Hotel Laguna, where I now have a Weiland Gallery from Laguna. So it was so powerful. But now I'm, you know, I have about 30 Weiland galleries all over Hawaii, California, of course, Vegas and Florida. And now I have my gallery in Santa Monica, which is really the mecca for ocean conservation. I mean, all the environmentalists are here, art lovers in L.A., so this is going to be very successful. I'm an artist like you that really like people.
I want to ask you a question, because I believe I'm a surgeon. My passion is the world of medicine, the world of art, and certainly the world of sports. And I believe they're all interconnected. One of the things that I appreciate most about you that's different from another artist is you really teach us how to see a part of the world that we really don't see, which is what's under the ocean that many of us don't get to see. So you really teach us how to see differently. I want you to listen. I want your reaction. This is Magic Johnson. This right. is really coming from Magic Johnson appreciating the great Pete Maravich, who you'll remember. Listen to what Magic Johnson is saying, and I want to hear your reaction.
You know, when you're born, they tell us we only have two eyes. But that's not true. Actually, we have about 100 eyes. We just got to train ourselves to use all those eyes. For instance, say we're coming down the court on a fast break. Now you're looking to see who's behind you, who's in front of you, who's running fast, who's running slow, where's the defense, who's free, who's got a shot, who can block that shot, who's open, the passing lanes, the cracks, the seams, you're just moving fast. Now, who's going to see all of that with just two eyes?
What do you think of that?
Well, I think Magic Johnson saw it, I mean, obviously, and Pistol Pete Maravich, I was number 44 because of him. I played basketball, you know, all through school in Detroit. I was the captain of the basketball team, and I am the biggest Laker fan, even when I was in Detroit.
Get out of here!
Okay, but no, I'm a Laker fan to the core, and I met Jerry West and Magic, and Jerry Buss was great. Yeah, I've been to a gazillion.
Have you ever been in the operating room and seen surgery, man? I would love to take
you.
I need you to come and paint what a meniscus looks like inside someone's knee. You would make the most incredible painting of a meniscus.
Oh, consider it done, man. Let's get together and let's, you know, I'm going to stay with the Lakers forever. I mean, they really inspired me. But you're right. Sports, of course, medicine and art, it's all connected, isn't it?
But I will tell you, Weiland, the greatest compliment that you can give Magic Johnson or a surgeon or a plumber or an electrician or a board operator in a radio station, that you're not just good, you're an artist. The highest right. compliment you can bestow on another human being is to refer to them as an artist. And you, Weiland, are an artist. And I want to thank you so much for getting up early to be with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, Dr. Clapper, you too, man. I like your passion.
Okay, buddy. All right. Have a great day. God bless you. All right. That's the great Weiland. Google him. Look at his work. Watch him make one of these paintings. He truly is the Michelangelo of marine life. Such a pleasure to be able to talk to him. I leave you with Volare, which means I'm singing and I'm flying, which you know we, the two of us do each and every Saturday morning. Thanks for telling your friends. Until then, I'll see you on the radio.